and the title actually says olfactory receptors and the statistical model for molecular recognition, and they are connected to each other. So while this is heating up, I will say what is going to be the structure of my talk. I will try, and I know this word means a lot in this audience. I will try to tell you in 1 hour about the olfactory system and our fascination with it as a model for molecular recognition. And in the second hour, I will try to share with you some thoughts that we have developed over the last 10 years or so that stem from our understanding of olfaction, try to generalize into some better understanding of what molecular recognition in biology is all about. And towards the end, I will show you a couple of slides that show how this model becomes pertinent to what I will be talking about next month, which is the origin of life. And I know there is a lot of hubris in saying, I work on the origin of life. You think people think either you're a crook or you are out of your mind. In all honesty, I think that everybody should work on the origin of life, because in biology, it's probably, or maybe in all of science, it's the only tangible, immediately available, right here problem that we have no solution for. How did we all originate? It's not string theory, with all due respect, where you have to go to very high energies or go very far in the cosmos. It's right here, right here. Okay, so, but this is not the topic of my talk. The topic of my talk is the olfactory system. Why are we fascinated with it? Inside the recesses of our nose, there resides a system that is capable of recognizing practically any molecular structure, provided in us that it is volatile, but that's not a very profound prerequisite, because there are animals that swim in the water and smell inside water. And also, we have several other chemosensory systems. We, vertebrates, have several other chemosensory systems for non-volatile chemicals, such as taste, and one which is much less known called the vomeronasal organ, which is an alternative nose that many animals have for non-volatile chemicals. Well, when snakes... Aha, no, just cancer, right? No password. When snakes sniff worms for prey with their tongue, they bring in proteins from the trail and they sniff them with a vomeronasal organ. So the olfactory system is a receptor for everything, basically. This is still thinking. And the question is, how does it work? So there are more systems like that in our body that are receptors for everything, the immune system being a prominent one. So almost any compound with a certain limit of molecular weight that you inject into your body will produce antibodies. And the question is, how does it happen? The answer came already a long time ago with MacFarlane Burnet and others with a clonal selection theory of the immune system. That is, there are ready to go immunoglobulins, a whole repertoire of them, that is, on the whole, as a matter of principle, untouched by the antigen, except by the antigen going in and selecting the best binders, enhancing those clones, as we say, and making an immune response. What happens in the olfactory system? We conjectured for 20 years now, and this turns out to be fact, that there are a pre-prepared set of receptors. Maybe I can do it without slides. Pre-prepared set of receptors that it sits there waiting for an odorant to come into the nose and see what happens. Which one is that? I guess it's off right here. It will crash again because there is something about this particular talk that this computer doesn't like. And if it crashes again, then I will try to take time and divide it into two. I think it doesn't like the size of it. Is it possible? But on occasion it works. So I'm going to show you in the first slide a quite amusing show of how a dog traces a pheasant in a lawn using his sense of smell. This is the slide right here that will become bigger very soon. And in this you see the dog zigzagging its way and utilizing all the marvels of the olfactory system, namely its capacity to distinguish grass from whatever the pheasant left behind, selectivity. Very few molecules pheasants leave are sufficient for noses to detect them. Therefore, there is a very high sensitivity. And there is also a time constant. It zigzags around and it asks, is it going up or down, and then it finds its way. It's still thinking. These computers need to be enhanced. They are not for these 5 megabyte talks that we now give. Or maybe we should go back to transparencies. Okay, so let's see now if it doesn't crash on me again. And I have to do this, I guess. And now we pray. So this is the zigzag story. Sensitivity, selectivity, and speed. There is one more item that I need to attend to, which is that I have no batteries here, I think. So how do you explain at the molecular level this capacity of the olfactory system? First and foremost, its ability to smell anything. An organic chemist, a crazy organic chemist, can make any compound that has never existed in the universe, and the nose would still be able to smell it. How does it work? Plus up, I guess, but I'm not sure. We'll give it a try.
But is that only because that organic compound is similar to some other organic compound?
The answer in principle is yes. Compounds look alike in principle. So the one of the most important aspects of my talk, both hours, will be that there is nothing very mysterious about molecular recognition, that it is a statistical phenomenon that suffices to make 1,000 receptors, 1,000,000 receptors, depending on the system, and then billions and zillions of different configurations can be recognized.
Recognizing combinations, right?
This is a separate story. We'll come to in a moment. So this is just what we have inside our noses, an array of cells, sensory neurons, about 10 million in us, 100 million in a dog, and there are nerve fibers that go into a region of the brain called the olfactory bulb that sits just above, in between our eyes. Very small epithelium, a few centimeters square in us. Dogs have many more centimeter squares or inches squares, but it's a rather small organ. It's the retina of smell. And what happens en route between the olfactory epithelium and the brain is of much interest to people. In the endings of these sensory neurons, there is a molecular mechanism about which I will not talk today. I will only spend some time with the receptors shown in red here, which are the ones that give rise to selectivity. They are the only selective entity in this system. Everything else is shared by all the different kinds of sensory neurons that we have in our sensory epithelium. But just to say, there is an amplifier protein. One of these can activate many G proteins. We heard a little bit about that before. This, in turn, activates a second component of the cascade called adenylyl cyclase, which makes a second messenger intracellularly. This is the cell here. This is the membrane. And then this activates an ion channel that generates an electrical current that goes to the brain and tells it we smell something. These are turn-off mechanisms. So selectivity, sensitivity by amplification, and speed by termination that allows you to smell again in the next sniff. Now comes the story of the logic of olfaction. There are, we know, about 1,000 different kinds of sensory cells in the epithelium of a typical vertebrate. Actually, a typical mammal. Lower vertebrates have fewer. So there are 1,000 different colors, so to speak, of different kinds of cells. And it turns out, starting as a hypothesis in our own laboratory and ending up being proved, that each sensory cell makes only one kind of molecular receptor. Not necessarily the case, but a very nice way to construct a logic of such system. Because then each cell actually represents a receptor. But does each receptor represent an odor? The answer is odorant. The absolute answer is absolutely not. Each of those can bind dozens of different ligands, and in turn, each of the ligands will bind to more than one receptor. This again will come to focus in my second talk, trying to explain why it is more so in the olfactory system than in quite a few others. So there is promiscuity in the system, and the way that the brain processing here makes sense of all that is by pattern recognition. So it doesn't matter that each ligand activates many receptors as long as there is a unique vector, as shown here, that gets generated for each receptor. And furthermore, if you bring in a mixture of odorants here, doesn't matter. The vectors just sum up. Perhaps not exactly linearly. There are many, many questions to be answered there. But in principle, the vectors sort of sum up, just like if you bring in a green photon and a red photon, they sum up together in our retina to show green and red together. What do they show?
Black.
No.
Black.
Another guess. No. No. Pure green, pure red. What do they show? Yellow. That's funny. You're physicists. You should know that. But it's not physics. It's in the brain. There is something in the brain that interprets the admixture of green and the exact ratios of activating the three types of receptors. We only have three instead of 1,000 or so in the olfactory system. Those three, when activated in one particular ratio, show to the brain green, another ratio red. None of the types of photons, no wavelength, activates only one type of receptor. Always a mixture. So mixtures mix together to give yet more perceptions. Same here. So this is the story of the logic of olfaction. And you distinguish between colors.
Well, but
not
when you mix the colors.
Even if you mix the colors.
But we just gave an example.
Oh, the question is of gestalt. That is an interesting story. When you mix odors, oftentimes you can, if they're very disparate, you can tell them apart. But more often than not, every day our experience is a unique gestalt out of a mixture. Strawberry is a gestalt, mango is a gestalt, avocado is, bread, potatoes, everything is a unique experience. You call it by name, but it's a mixture of sometimes hundreds of chemicals.
But could you mix A and B? Who smells smell A and smell B and get something completely different, like smell C?
Yes. Yes, but the logic of it is not simple. I will come to it towards the end of my talk, perhaps. We have a company that deals with it. It's called DigiSense. It's a company that purports to bring smell to the media because we only have vision and audition. But this is really outside the realm of my talk. I will talk about it more. Let me say a few words about the molecules that give rise to specificity here. These are the receptors. They are of the kind that is called 7 transmembrane domain receptors. They thread through the membrane 7 times. Each of the segments within the membrane is a helix. And what we did, and I will tell you a little bit about this, leading towards the, trying to understand the specificity, and leading also to the second talk next hour, we now begin to understand, by beginning with genomes, as I told some of you in an earlier talk, using the genome project, starting from chromosomes, we look at segments of DNA that contain receptor genes. These are the receptor genes. And then we try to interpret the sequence of the DNA in terms of a structure of protein, and also trying to interpret what we see genome-wide in terms of how the whole repertoire evolved. Hundreds and hundreds of such receptors. Okay, each of these lines represents about 100,000 bases of DNA. So it's a kind of a zooming in or zooming out. You start from a segment on a chromosome, which may be, say, 1 million or 1.5 million bases. This particular one is 500,000 bases. But this is typical genomics, as mentioned in the previous talk. And you focus on one of these segments, say 100,000 bases, DNA bases long, and you sequence it. Now, the whole thing is sequenced. All we have to do is to look in the computer. Not always simple, because it's fragmentary. I mentioned that in my previous talk. So then you look at a segment, and you analyze it by your computers to ask what's in there. And I will immediately say a few more words about exactly what we do. And each of those then blooms into a structure, which is the protein structure coded in the CD, in the DNA.
That transmembrane protein is not really linear in the array of 7 elements. It's one in the middle, it sticks around the outside.
It's a snake. It snakes in and out, in and out, in and out. It's one continuous polypeptide chain. Oh, it's actually a cylinder. It's actually a cylinder. Thank you for the comment. So we coined the notion of what is known as the OR, olfactory receptor gene superfamily, or olfactory subgenome, which is all the pieces of DNA, segments of DNA that code for olfactory receptors. We now know that they are disposed throughout the genome, and they have a very simple gene structure. We heard already about exons and introns and so on, and a lot about DNA binding proteins that act in front of genes. So this is a typical gene. The promoter would be right here, although the promotion of these receptors is very obscure. One of the enigmas is how do you make sure that each cell only makes one of these receptors? It is all in the hands of DNA binding proteins, but exactly how, we don't yet know. So there is a promoter here, and then typically the coding region, the business end, is all in this dark red portion, which is for a 300 amino acid long protein, is about 1,000 long DNA segment. It's all in one exon in most cases, and there are some upstream exons. We don't exactly know what they do, but they help make the final messenger RNA, although this orange guy does not get into that portion of the DNA that codes for the protein. And as you already heard throughout this conference, or throughout this school, there is a whole cascade of decisions of how you go from DNA to messenger, to RNA, which is not yet processed, then the introns go out, and then you get a piece of DNA, which some of it codes for protein, but the rest is also important for some dynamics of the cell, such as deciding exactly when and how to begin to translate a protein, or deciding what is the fate of the messenger RNA, such as how long will it live in the cell. This is in the hands of the dotted regions. So this is just, in a nutshell, looking again at the main dogma of molecular biology through the eyes or through the nose of olfaction.
So, is it really true that one cell only makes one receptor? 99%.
So there may be, and in biology, please remember, nothing is absolutely strict in biology. But on the other hand, there is what I call the first axiom of biology. Everything is possible. It is really true. When you consider it from a physicist's point of view, in biology, everything is possible. Look at what we are doing. Soon enough, we will move black holes around in the universe, like in a million years from now, which is only a blink for evolution. Well, you can actually do something like, again, I talk in jargon that some of you already heard about, so I apologize, but you do PCR, polymerase chain reaction, on individual cells. You can tease them out. And you do individual cells, and you ask, does it or does it not amplify more than one gene that codes for an olfactory receptor? And more often than not, almost always, you get one, and on occasion you get two, but never 1,000. So it's quite a strict rule. So, I already mentioned the idea that we have the genome in our hands, and the olfactory subgenome is actually part of this, and even mentioned with me as an author in this particular paper, which I think makes me a little proud, although it's a multiple author paper. So, very quickly, how do you fish out? We started by physically fishing out genes for olfactory receptors from the genome by PCR and by some other means. We ended up fishing in computers. And this is true for all of biology now. It becomes
When you say PCR, what kind of primary is public? How can you be sure that you only PCR?
Okay. Okay. The answer is this. Actually, the answer has something to do with this diagram. This diagram has to do with asking what is an olfactory receptor. In hindsight wisdom, or actually mid-sight, it has some hindsight and some foresight. We can look at some examples of olfactory receptors that we already believe they are. I will immediately answer your question. And then ask how similar are they to each other, and how similar are they to other candidate segments of DNA that might code for olfactory receptors. And there is a clustering phenomenon. Each receptor has its nearest neighbor some others, and you can make a cluster this way and define by and large what olfactory receptors are. The first time olfactory receptors got discovered was based on our original discovery that the system works through a G protein. This gave rise to the hypothesis in our hands that the receptor would be GPCR, G protein coupled receptor, like the visual receptors, like many hormone receptors, and like many neurotransmitter receptors in the brain. It will come immediately. I will say it is. Yes. Yes. But I haven't gotten there. I said GPCR, G protein coupled receptors. These biologists are impossible with their acronyms. But you are the first to point out to me that GPCR contains PCR in it. This is nice. Yes. So the first time that got discovered, the way that Buck and Axel discovered the first genes in a rat was the following logic. If it is GPCRs, let's use PCR, polymerase chain reaction, oligos from other GPCRs, like dopamine receptors and adrenergic receptors and so on. The distance is very large. These are the other GPCRs, and these are olfactory receptors. But don't turn the lights on. I think this will be enough here. In this 1,000 long protein, there are a few segments that are highly conserved. They are conserved between other GPCRs and olfactory receptors, and more so within olfactory receptors. So if you amplify there very tenuously, you can jump the chasm between G-protein-coupled receptors of other kinds to olfactory receptors. Once done, you can roam in olfactory receptor space using those quite highly conserved segments. Actually, in the structure of the molecule, they are disposed around transmembrane 2 and around transmembrane 7. We call it the 2 to 7 amplification. And you do that, you get most of your receptor. And not only that, the business end is in the middle. We think that most odorant binding sites or complementarity determining residues are in transmembranal domains 3, 4, and 5. So if you amplify between 2 and 7, you get quite a nice picture. And then you can, using genomics, you can move around and find the flanking sequences of those receptors.
The G-protein was that transmembrane receptor?
Let me try to go back to this for a moment, because I think, although I promised myself not to answer questions, I have to answer a few. I mean, not to answer questions that will not allow me to finish the talk in time. But still, we owe you some explanation. So this, I hope it doesn't crash on me. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Oh, no, it's still thinking. Okay. Can you see here?
Yes.
This is the receptor. The purple guys are the G proteins. It doesn't. Okay, no, I don't want to touch this picture. PowerPoint. So this amplifier protein is very stereotyped. It happens in thousands of receptors. And it's a telltale sign of the kind of receptor this is, because there are other families of receptors, such as protein kinase receptors, tyrosine kinase receptors, and so on. This superfamily, hyperfamily of receptors includes visual receptors, olfactory receptors, neurotransmitter receptors, and hormone receptors. They all go through a relatively small family of purple guys, of G proteins, hence G protein coupled receptors.
The G proteins are strictly olfactory system, or aren't they more general?
I thought I already said that they weren't, but let me reiterate. This kind of mechanism is shared by thousands of different kinds of receptors, including olfactory receptors. Okay, I'm sorry. I should be more patient. Okay, so let me see. What is the best way to go? If I do this, and I touch this too fast, it will crash. So I'll touch this slowly. Okay, so the story of olfactory receptors is that we suspected for long that there was a large family of receptors, and then we were out to find them, and we found them various different ways, and right now we have basically the whole superfamily of olfactory receptors at hand, and this is a mining paradigm that I will not tell you in detail about, that starts from a genome and ends with well-defined about 1,000 coding regions out of this mess and mass of data that exists in the genomic databases. And they all share sequence similarity at the level of at least 30% at the protein identity level.
So there are only about 1,000 receptors?
Yes, not only. This is the largest family of receptors in our genome. It's the most glorious invention of nature, olfaction. The immune system has many fewer genes because it uses combinatorics. Not many fewer, but it utilizes a few hundred pieces of DNA to make 10 million different kinds of proteins by several levels of combinatorics, at a DNA level and also at a protein level with the light chain, heavy chain combinatorics. This is for an immune system talk. So, but it's important to say that the olfactory system uses a different strategy. Each gene codes for one protein. And this is profound, and the reason for that is that for the olfactory system, as will unravel itself afterwards, 1,000 is a good number, and it appears as if, for the immune system, a repertoire of 1,000 will kill us all. We need a repertoire of 10 million, and that's very important, and it's important to ask why. So here is the olfactory subgenome in all its glory, all of these volumes of genetic encyclopedia, as I coined them in my last talk. And the red regions are where there are olfactory receptors, and the tiny histograms show their prevalence, how many there are inside each of those bands. So it's quite an elaborate system, and it looks like they scattered all about. You can make sense of this group of receptors by principal component analysis, for example, just taking all the sequences and generating a space out of them. So you have 1,000 receptors, or let's say here we used only about 300 of them. So you use a 300-dimensional space, you reduce its dimensionality, and you ask about groupings. And one group stands out quite clearly. We call it class one, and it turns out that these are the only receptors that aquatic animals like fish have. The cyan, is that the name of this color? The light blue. Okay, so we are talking sequence space. They are more remote from all others than all others are among themselves, but still they are within a group that can be, with very strong statistical significance, be shown to belong to the same superfamily. So all of this is the same superfamily. So this stands out more than everything. This stands out a little less. And then there is a cloud which can still be deciphered by way of calling these receptors family one, family two, family three, and so on. Yes. They are more localized than scattered. They are localized in the flanks of the protein and in the middle where the binding site is. And that's a funny situation because usually binding sites are hallmarks of conservation. But here, a binding site, because there are 1,000 instances and each should bind different odorants, the binding site is actually a peak in variability in the variability diagram, as I will immediately show you. Now, okay. There are two different spots, big and small. The big are good bona fide receptors. The small are ones that have undergone changes that render them pseudogenes. More about this in a few moments.
And peptide is a core for the
future? For a, what do you call it? For limb creature.
Limb.
Because we have two hands and two feet, and they have. Yeah, we are tetrapod, absolutely. You don't have to walk on all of them to belong to them. And we have walked on all of them until very recently anyway. So, okay. This is just another way of parsing the receptors into families, just doing a tree which conveys structural information, but also hides within it evolutionary information, telling you that if you branch very near to the center, you must have branched long ago, and if you branch like here, more near to the periphery, then you are a relatively new invention of nature. And our entire genome must have gotten generated by this process of gene duplication, and we see it all about. As a nutshell idea, we have a genome that has very clear hallmarks of having undergone complete duplication. We call it polyploidization. Complete duplication twice in the history of vertebrates. So we started from a genome a quarter of our size, then it went to a half our size, then it went to full size. All mammals have this full size. Actually, all vertebrates have. This is not in the history of vertebrates, it's in the history of eukaryotes. For very simple animals, the genome was much smaller, the invertebrates and so on, and it underwent duplication as a whole. And then those new genome territories acquired new functions. We ask a question about the phase of variability. We do a Fourier analysis, and we find that variability shows a periodicity of about 3.5, which means that as you go around helices, and most of the business here is in helices, that one side, one face is variable, and another face is constant. So this gives rise to a notion of some kind of a pocket that is lined by, let me skip this. This is another technology that I don't have time now to talk about. But you end up with a notion, based on all the information we gathered, that there is a pocket right here lined by variable amino acids, and this might be the complementarity determining region of olfactory receptors.
Circle?
I'm sorry. I was skipping. We're looking face on, head on into this seven helix structure. And mentioned already, I should have said it, it's like a flattened cylinder. So it goes in, out, and so on. And you just look at the cross section. And you also do the following, you flatten it so that amino acids, no matter what they have in the z-axis, will show the radial coordinate around this circle, which signifies the helix. So you can see then that along the length of the helix, they tend to cluster on one face.
What do the letters mean in the
circle? These letters are actually some conserved residues, this being aspartic acid, this being asparagine, proline, etc., in the single letter code that we all got to know so well. Some of you already know it by heart, right? What is tryptophan? Good. So, but this was... Do you know why tryptophan is W? Because the chemical shape of the residue looks like a W, because it has two rings. So once you get... you couldn't call it T, because that's taken already by threonine. Tyrosine couldn't be called T, so you take the second letter, Y, tyrosine. And for tryptophan, T was absolutely absent, so we used W. Which is nice in this country. W is a good letter now, right? Okay, so we have this is conjectural. We don't know that the binding site looks really like this, but we now look into the binding site. We do it for different receptors, and we see this mosaic of contact residues, and this actually leads to my next talk, which will be after the break.
So there was some story you were going to tell.
You said you don't have time to tell your wife about it. What you want to
something you said.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of things.
What was it?
I'll think about it. But some of it I'll tell in the next hour. Okay. So we know.
So there is no difference between male and female in humans.
There seems to be no genotypic difference in the receptor. But you know, becoming male is a set of events that is triggered by some genes on chromosome Y,
right,
which then funnels its way through some genes that are shared by males and females by way of this gene activation cascade. So if you have an initiation point, you make a gene that females don't have.
Yes.
This would activate a gene that females have, but never gets active, or gets active less, and then you end up with all the differences that exist between males and females.
Now, I actually read in a popular book that the X chromosome actually attacks the Y chromosome, is that right?
Yeah.
In fact, one reason that Y chromosome is so short is somehow it got chopped off by the X chromosome.
Yeah, there is some kind of, like, did you read this book, Gino?
Yeah, that's the book I read.
It's a beautiful book.
Yeah, in fact, I thought that was a preparation for this program.
It's a very nice question.
No, he's a good writer. He's definitely a good writer.
I actually helped translate this into Hebrew.
Oh, you did?
So I like this book.
Yeah.
So there is some kind of a war stage between the two.
Yeah. No, I've written some popular physics books, and recently my editor came to see me. So I was, I told him how much I enjoyed that book. So at one point I told him, if I learn enough biology, I should write a popular book.
About biology.
And
someone
said, no, you can't do that. You
They don't
I said, why can a journalist write a book about biology?
the best books are written by people from outside the field because they see the overview and they don't get bogged down in detail.
So this guy clearly, he is just a good writer. This guy, whatever his name is. He used to write for The Economist.
Yeah, his name is Matthew.
Matt Ridley. Ridley. I read two of his other books too. There was one on the emergence of virtue.
Of what?
Of virtue.
Of virtue.
You know, this thing about how we are reading the possibly virtue.
Yes.
Well, it was very interesting. And then The Red Queen. How the system. That's also because you read some book written by a professional biologist, can really walk down. all kinds of detail.
Yeah, but there are some good biology.
Yeah, Dawkins. Dawkins, I like Stephen Jay Gould, Clark. Although a lot of people say that some of the things he said is wrong, right? Like the Cambrian explosion.
Well, there are many conjectural items in evolution because we don't have all the data. A little bit like cosmology. So I think it's excusable.
Well, you know what happened when a physicist writes a popular book about physics? Often, you know, the guy would tend to blow up his own research area, little area, which is a global picture, maybe a small.
Let me see if my talk works so that I don't disappoint you. Let's try to discuss it now. But in principle, how big is the dimensionality? Or? Okay, the dimensionality is marked by how many receptors there are. Is about, you know, the dimensionality of vision is 3. In a way that is subtly related to the fact that it's
psychophysical experiments, analogists.
I just want to make sure that my talk is sorry.
Yeah. So, I'll talk to you about once on these olfactory receptors. How many of them have the worm homolog?
The what?
Worm, the
Seligman's homolog. Almost the same number. They have 600 receptors. That's
but
an interesting story.
They are very similar?
They are very different. It is if they evolved in a completely different route of evolution, but with
it's
the same principle.
Different things.
Same, yeah, well, no. It's a funny thing. Because of this probabilistic mechanism, it doesn't matter which thousand you make, it will smell the same universe, which I'm going to try to underline now. That's actually an important point that I should make in my talk. Can we actually start, or is it too early? Well, otherwise, I will never finish.
People are still wondering.
Okay. So shall I start talking?
Yeah, you can start pretending started it.
Okay. Okay, I know how to do that.
The dog has several thousand.
Dog
has more.
May have just 1,000. We don't know that it has more, but it may have a much more elaborate brain fold function. So. But still, it is maybe 3 or 4 times as many as we do. Maybe this is an interesting story that we may or may not decide to tackle, whether dogs really have undergone a profound expansion of the repertoire. But we have to realize that dogs and mice are just as good, except that we know how to talk to dogs and say, go ahead and find the lost child. And we don't know how to do this with a mouse. But it could. Okay, I'm ready to go.
So what's the typical binding energy? Is that known?
This I'm going to talk about immediately.
And the specificity you have been talking about?
Yeah.
Versus the sensitivity.
Okay. I was told to start speaking so people come in.
So I...
really get recordings out of this?
Oh, yeah.
And do you, can they be used?
Yeah, it's posted on the web.
So you can actually listen to it. Yeah, yeah, I know. Okay. Perfect. No, I actually looked at it a little bit. So, I will use the... Yes?
How can talking going to be a tool for college autonomy?
So my departure point for my second talk is olfaction, as was actually the history of this story. I became keenly interested in the question of how one can generalize what you see in the olfactory system to more specific, or I would say not less specific, to more all-encompassing aspects of biology. So, yes, it's protein strength. So, with a little bit of hubris, I would say a theory of everything for biology. Can we understand what goes on in terms of molecular recognition by way of a statistical model? And let me explain. And this actually was actually quite nicely introduced by the talk that you heard about from David Moroz about the statistics of DNA segments and their recognition by proteins. So think of these as DNA binding proteins and these as DNA segments. It's just the same. You have many DNA binding proteins and many DNA segments, and they play the game of trying to find each other's partner. Now, is there a unique partner? Never. Not in any system that we know. Multispecificity is the name. There is always the case that one binds many and many bind to one. But biology somehow makes sense of it by way of conveying to us a semblance of a one-to-one relationship. But look at what the drug industry is doing. They invent similes to ligands that exist in our brain. So each of the receptors in the brain can bind hundreds of other compounds. Some may be toxic, they get thrown away. Some may be cross-reactive because they bind a little bit too much to something they shouldn't bind to. But on the whole, there are hundreds of compounds for each receptor. So this is a very common phenomenon. And the question is whether we can understand it a little more in depth. Now, the basic notion of this entire system is what you see here, and you've heard this umpteen times, so I will not repeat it in too much detail. There are two counterparts, and actually it is symmetric. Very often ligand is the smaller guy and receptor is the larger guy. But there are also very many ligands that are as big as the receptors, or sometimes even bigger. So size really doesn't matter. And what matters is that there are two counterparts that for convenience we call R receptor and H. I use usually H because L is something else in my nomenclature. And H is hapten. And hapten is a name used for a small molecular weight analog of an antigen in the immune system, sort of a part of an antigen. And hapten comes from to grab in Greek, so it is actually nice. Ligand H, receptor R, and what they have in between them are several different interactions, each of a very low energy, about 1 kilocalorie per mole on order, and together with geometrical complementarity, hydrogen bonds, ion-ion interaction, dipole-dipole interactions, and hydrophobic interactions, as shown here, are what gives rise to all that we know about biology. Now, in the model that I'm going to discuss with you in the next few minutes, I will try to stay away from the nuts and bolts of the actual hydrogen bonds and actual hydrophobic patches and try to symbolize this by virtual elementary interactions. So elementary interactions are the units of non-covalent stereospecific binding, and I will try to use a model in which these come into play but in a more virtual way. Virtual subsites, virtual elementary interactions. As the talk unfolds, please remember, I'm not talking about the individual hydrogen bonds that A and T form to each other or C and G, but a more subtle way of looking at things, which allows me to generalize. Because the question is, how do you go from what you really understand very well, which is that A always likes T and G always likes C, and you can infer very easily what will bind to what, to a case in which it is very difficult to infer. If you are given two potential counterparts, right now there is no algorithm that tells you with certainty which way and to what degree they will bind to each other. But as I already mentioned, multispecificity is the name of the game. This is already pointed out by several researchers, including in the paper that you see here. John Inman and others have talked about it quite a bit. The idea being that if you have one antibody as an example of a receptor, there can be very disparate different ligands that bind to it. And you can see it pictorially here. This one utilizes the crevice here and makes two interactions here that this doesn't even think of doing. But this makes interactions here that this doesn't. And on the whole, they get the same binding energy for different ways of playing their game.
And a hapten is the olfactory analog of
a hapten is a word that immunologists use for a small antigen. If you inject a protein, you get an immune response. If you chop this protein into peptides, or even if you take an analog that is relatively small, a few dozen atoms, that also binds to the same antibody, it's called a hapten. But in general, we are talking about a ligand. And people like Alan Lapidus here and others that are shown here have discussed in the past the notion of shape space. And Alan actually has an interesting model that goes along much the same vein. And the idea is that you can think of a space in which all of these molecules roam. And proximity in this space means we bind to each other strongly. If you're more remote, you bind less. And you can think, if there was a way to somehow formalize the notion of shape plus the potential elementary interactions, a donor of hydrogen bond and a patch of hydrophobic residues here and so on and so forth, if there was a way to formalize this into a real space, this would have been wonderful because this would allow us to infer binding. We cannot do it yet. But you can go towards it by, for example, defining a sphere that is, again, in a virtual way, defines what binds better or worse. So there is a cutoff of greater than affinity k molar to the minus 1 that will go into this sphere. In a very simplistic pictorial way, one could think of the question of probability of different degrees of stereospecific fit. And it makes sense that being able to do this is more likely than being able to do that. It requires more definition, more information, more being just the right kind, the right size, and the right residues to form the interaction. So there should be some kind of a probability distribution for being high affinity, probability low, for being medium affinity, so low affinity or quite high, and there may be even a dip in probability space or probability dimension.
Known in some cases or some
this is my talk. What is the shape of this blue curve? L is the number of interactions here. 3 here, 6 here, 10 here. Again, it's sort of virtual, but how many successful elementary interactions can you make? And thank you for pointing it out, Tony, because I will need this L all along, and it's good that we define it right away. MacFarlane-Burnett, already in, not shown here, actually, this is terrible, 1967, let's see if I can make it out, had a thoughtful guess about what happens. He actually drew this curve. I don't know how he did that. But he said most of the molecules will show a maximal affinity, while only an occasional, no, a minimal affinity, it should be, will show a high affinity. The rarity of high affinity in immunoglobulins is precisely for similar reasons that four aces are rarely dealt in a poker hand. I did it. So this is in 1967. 1967, Burnett already thought of the idea that high affinity is low probability and vice versa, and he drew a shape that is surprisingly similar to what we think really happens. I never found out how. Here, why doesn't it go here?
Why does it go down?
Well, for the same reason that if it's like a binomial distribution.
But
okay, affinity actually has no lower limit in principle, but there is an effective limit. Okay, so yeah, if it's L, then it goes to zero and that's it. But there can be all sorts of complications. There could be negative interactions that is disturbing ones. I will go into some more detail immediately, but the point is that the curve doesn't go all the way down, although theoretically it could. So what is this curve? What is this probability function that we call psi of k that says so many receptors of this affinity, let's say 10 to the 6, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 4, and so on. And this is very similar to what we heard before about questions such as proteins that bind to DNA. There is a distribution. If you take DNA segments, there may be DNA, a few of them that are very, very good, and quite a few along the genome that are quite terrible in binding to this particular target.
So K is a surrogate for L?
No, okay. It's not surrogate, but they are logarithmically related to each other. L is the number of successful interactions. Basically, it's like the free energy change upon binding.
Yep.
If, as I will immediately show, in a very simple-minded model, you assume that each interaction provides a similar increment of energy. K is that binding constant which we heard about, which is defined as the complex divided, concentration of complex divided by the free concentrations of the two reactants. This is K. It has a dimensionality of molar to the minus 1, and it actually measures the tendency of the two components to go into a complex. And it is known that log K is linearly related to the free energy change.
But the curve?
This for the moment this is a cartoon, but what is important is that you can ascribe what I say here for any collection of receptors and an arbitrary ligand. This was the thought experiment that I performed in my head about 15 years ago. Let us look at all the olfactory receptors and let's put in a probe ligand. We can measure the affinity for each receptor. It's measurable. And we get a distribution. We get a population property. How many show such affinity? How many such affinity? We divide them into bins. What could be the shape of this distribution? I think it's quite a profound question in biology because, as I will immediately say, actually I have it right there, there is a potential of universality here. Questions about this probability distribution. Is it the same for all receptor repertoires? Now, receptor repertoires are figments of our own imagination. We call all the olfactory receptors are repertoire, but actually you could take a few receptors from olfaction, a few receptors from immune system, and a few enzymes and call them a repertoire. Any collection of proteins. Is there a universality there? Is there a universality for ligands? Or actually, is it symmetric? Does it matter whether we call this a ligand and this a receptor? If it is not absolutely universal, could at least the functional form of psi be universal? And if so, what are the parameters for different, I don't know what this happens, receptor and ligands. This is the pasting that I did yesterday late night. Could psi be experimentally determined? Very important for experimentalists, although I enjoy being among physicists because they ask the question, have you determined this experimentally, only as a second question. First they ask, is it elegant? And I like that. So I think this may be elegant. And what are the consequences of knowing psi? So here is a toy model. I learned to say this, although the first time I read the word toy model was in Freeman and Dyson's book on the origin of life, which I really admire and follow with zest. So here is a toy model. The toy model is divide the receptor into subsites, divide the ligand into subsites, virtual as already mentioned. Define a dimensionality, which is one parameter of the system, which is how many subsites there are. It's a free parameter of the system. And then there are simplifying assumptions here. We assume for the beginning that the dimensionality on both sides is the same, immediately to be shown that it doesn't have to be the case. And therefore, and also that there is no sliding, that is that you cannot fit it like that. And the vector elements represent subside configurations, potential elementary interactions, as mentioned, not real ones. This is all in a paper that we published 8 years ago, and in which we coined the notion of receptor affinity distribution, or RAD model. So you could think of an infinite carpet of such, something that we have coined the probabilistic Langmuir surface. Langmuir, as you know, has studied the binding of volatile ligands or soluble ligands to solid surfaces. But it is exactly the same notion. You get the exact same equation and the same kind of behavior, like here, a parabolic saturation curve, whether you bind a gas to the surface of active charcoal or you bind a ligand to a receptor. And you could think, what happens if, unlike what Langmuir was entertaining, each of the subsites here was different, and there were actually somewhat different subsites than Langmuir. Langmuir subsites are the real binding sites for an entire molecule. And here I'm talking about subsites that define the interaction between a molecule and a surface. But in principle, you could think of an infinite or large surface, and actually a protein, a globular protein, when a ligand approaches it, presents a rather large surface, and the ligand somehow selects a particular patch to bind in. So there may be elaboration of the model along these lines.
I must be missing something. The ligand was represented as a vector, right? Why is there anything that's...
This is for biologists.
Sorry?
This is for biologists. It is a vector. It's a vector, H1, H2, H3, H4, H9, and it's made into a matrix because in physics, the physical aspects of it is that the binding sites are on a sort of
plane.
It's
different patches or
yeah.
Physical surface.
But when you go into the mathematics, it's a vector. Thank you for the question. And then you decide about a second parameter of the system. Very, very simple-minded. You'll all forgive me for that. You allow the R1, R2, and so on subsites, virtual subsites, to assume numbers. I mean, all of this is really stupid. This is for biologists. I shouldn't even say that. The end result is that we get a binomial distribution. We ask the question, maybe I shouldn't shortcut on that. You assume that you throw real integer, you throw natural numbers here, and you ask, and then you allow these numbers, and that's important from the point of view of the biological meaning in the back of your head, that there is only a certain range of numbers allowed, and this is sort of the diversity parameter of the system. So we define B as the size, S is subsite variability, again virtual. How many different numbers are allowed? B9 and F6 shown here, and we randomly assign subsite configurations, and then we say a successful interaction occurs when Ri equals Hi in the respective position in the vector. I should skip this, because this all of this, what it leads to is something that everybody will immediately understand, is the idea that you get a binomial distribution. There was a... Maybe it didn't come out in... Okay, yeah, it looks like the fonts got screwed up somehow today versus yesterday. But in principle, you ask, actually they look a little bolder here. If this is equal to that, this is equal to that, you count how many. What?
Between the lower right-hand corner back
here. Here, this should be bold. Yeah, something went wrong. Anyway, the idea is count the numbers, the number of instances in which numbers are equal. Very, very simple model, and it ends up with a binomial distribution. Could a binomial distribution describe nature? That is, what I'm trying to convey to you is the notion that fit between counterparts in biology is not a mystery. It's a statistical phenomenon. And this statistical phenomenon is governed, just like MacFarlane Burnet has said, by the same rules that govern the rarity of a good hand in ace. A good four-ace hand in poker. Sorry. And you get something like that, and the parameters B and S are inside. This is the diversity parameter. This is the size parameter, and L is the actual number of successes. So L is actually, as remembered from previous slides, it's the number of successful interactions, large or small, will determine how probable or improbable it is. So you get a curve. Now it's a computed curve for binomial binomial curve for B equals 20, an example of S equals 7. And I want to stress, and that's important, what is written here in blue. S is an effective diversity parameter. So we know there are 20 amino acids. We know there are 4 nucleotides. But nature is more complex than that. It's not true that always A will only bind to T. There is a measurable energy of interaction between A and C, and depends on the configuration and who are the neighbors and so on. It's definitely not true that we know that leucine will always bind to leucine and tyrosine will always bind to aspartic acid. We don't know anything like that. But we do, and we also know that if you make a protein surface that has only one kind of residue on it, it will be boring and it will have less binding capacity for diverse ligands than if you make it out of 20 amino acids. And in evolution, apparently a decision was made to go up to a diversity of 20 in real protein space, diversity of 4 in real DNA space and RNA space, but the virtual space, which signifies the capacity for variability in binding, may reside in a more effective type of S, which could be a 7 or 10 or something like that.
The S is a fitting parameter?
Yes, and in our model, in our phenomenological model, it's a fitting parameter. Now we introduce energy, again in a very simple-minded way. We assume that each successful interaction contributes a free energy change of alpha kilocalories per mole. Then delta G will be minus, or depending on the sign, well, never mind. Different people define it differently, minus alpha L. Alpha is the absolute value of the free energy change, which is always negative. And K, this beloved K here, will be this. Well, this is the gas constant. Chemists use this. Divide it by Avogadro number, you get Planck's constant. And so it's actually KT here. And I know that I shouldn't have written RG. That doesn't sound professional. And simplifying assumptions again, all elementary interactions have equal free energy. Only negative free energy favorable interactions are considered. You can elaborate the model otherwise. Is it necessary? The answer is probably not. So, the functional form of the affinity distribution, we propose that it is binomial, but immediately you will see that we also entertain a Poisson approximation and sometimes we use a Gaussian. They are all quite similar in the range of interest. And these are actual parameters that we got from the first experiment we did to try to extract from nature at least a very crude approximation of what the values of these three parameters could be that might describe perhaps all of biology in some respect or large chunks thereof. So psi is a binom with parameters 1 over s, b, and all of this which is l, the number of successful interactions. One potential elaboration would go in the direction of what Gary Stormont described to us, and that is to actually not say only successful, not a binary situation, successful, unsuccessful, alpha or zero, but actually have a lookup table for the numbers, those virtual numbers that we have. Maybe I shouldn't go into too much detail on that because we never used it in the end because we didn't think it was worth it. But you could think of a way by which if you have these numbers thrown in, if you have 2 here and 4 here, it will convey information about a certain degree of energy of binding. And if you have 2 and 3, it will be different. The model ends up overdetermined if you do this, and it is really enough to have 3 parameters. Even that is too much. How do you do experiments? I will show you 2 different approaches very quickly. One which we did already 9 years ago, and this was a crazy idea that I had, which goes in the way of what happens very often in science. That is, noise for some people is data for others. What is noise in biology? It's called non-specific binding. What is non-specific binding? It's the titration of a ligand into, if you do a cell gemisch, you just extract proteins from cells, and you have a good binder inside that gemisch, and you enter a ligand and you start titrating and ask how much ligand binds at each concentration, you'll get a curve in which your signal, the real receptor, is masked by non-specific binding, which has to do with the fortuitous binding of that specific ligand to everything else that is in that gemisch. Now, can we use this to extract important information? What if we took not exactly a cellular debris, but if we took all the immunoglobulins that the body can produce? You can buy this from Sigma. It's in a bottle. It's called normal serum immunoglobulin. It's only antibodies, but millions of them in the same bottle.
Different kinds,
different binding sites, different LH configurations, different recombinations, all in one bottle. It's quite a good deal. A small bottle will cost maybe $10. So it's cheap. You can get millions of receptors for $10.
And they come from animals?
This, we use bovine, it can come from another animal like human being and so on. Most mammals produce these. So now you do equilibrium dialysis, because this is important. You cannot do gel shift, you cannot do filter assays, because the affinities we are talking about are very, very small. So you have to do real equilibrium. And to do real equilibrium, you utilize something that is old-fashioned called equilibrium dialysis. Equilibrium dialysis is make a membrane semi-permeable. On one side, there is antibody plus the ligand. On the other side, the ligand alone. So there is actually antibody here. You can put the ligand either way. The ligand passes through the membrane and therefore equilibrates. But it will equilibrate unequally because there is a protein here and not here. So there will be more ligand total here than here. So you measure here bound plus free, and you measure here free only. And from that, and if you know the protein concentration, you immediately extract a value of K. Now, in our experiment, H is radio-labeled. So this is unlabeled, but these two are labeled because this is a complex between a radio-labeled compound and an unlabeled protein. So you just count radioactivity on both sides, and you do it at several different concentrations, and you get the protein binding.
You don't separate them.
No, that's the point. You just measure, you aliquot two sides, and you get a good number, which is a real equilibrium measure. And you do this as a titration.
And the immune globulin stays on the left side.
Exactly. It cannot pass through the holes.
Do you do this for different ligands?
Yes. So you do this for, we tried these three different ligands. We used all iodinated ligands. This is in the old days. So we used very, very cumbersome methodologies. And these are the curves that you get for the three ligands. So this is a binding curve now. A concentration here and how much bound. This is X. So X is a function of H, of free H. Actually, this is total H, but it is almost the same. No, we measure free and bound, sorry. We know exactly, this is a nice method in which you know both X and H. So you get, for example, these two curves are quite similar. This is slightly different, but broadly speaking, they are not very different. Now, if I did it with a real good receptor, this is zero binding, X is zero, this is 0.8, saturation would be up here. If I did it with a good binder, it would look like so. Much, much lower concentrations would saturate it. So this is sort of a residual noise, but it is exactly here and not here and not here. So it gives you some information. And we fitted this to our model, and we got these three parameters. So this is for one of the ligands. You can do just parameter fit, very simple-minded. So this is a crude experiment. No one would call it decisive, but it shows two items, agenda items. One, that you can extract some information from the way by which you titrate a ligand into a whole repertoire of receptors that contains some that are quite good for it. There are, inside this bottle, antibodies that will bind this ligand that is being titrated with an affinity of 10 to the 8. But as mentioned in previous talks, they are very rare. And there are some others that are more mediocre affinity, but are quite prevalent. And the total, you actually have to deconvolute this curve into the contributions of the different populations of binders.
Doesn't B equal 10 seem like a very big number, but a small?
It's a virtual number, but...
you expect that virtual number to get somewhat proportional to the size of that? I mean, I give you the surface...
Yes and no, because it's not really sizing what unit. The elementary interactions that we count in this model are virtual. They could be a quarter of an atom. We don't know what they are. So the size is really, really virtual. It only says nature behaves like this. But this is an important question because we discovered very quickly that we could use different pairs of B and S as long as the ratio was kept the same. So there was indeterminism there. And actually this ratio of B to S is exactly the single parameter of a Poisson distribution in an approximation. So we think that actually one parameter is enough, and then you can actually use big B and big S, or small B and small S, and to suit your taste, so to speak. Okay, so now an important point. I started this whole journey with a question of can we rationalize olfaction and many other, or some other, multi-receptor systems.
Then to get a distribution. Why are you doing this?
Well, this is physics, man. This is you can do something. If you don't want accurate numbers, you can get it from one experiment. This is not really one experiment. It's more. We did several. But I'll show you immediately that we did many more by looking at the literature. The question is, can you get an estimate of the parameters of a phenomenological model from a simple experiment? You don't need to bind each and every one of the members, because you assume a generality here, Terry. You assume that there is an underlying phenomenon with only two or three parameters. And if so, you can get an estimate from relatively few. You can ask the same. That's the point. Terry, that's the whole story. If you want to really measure the distribution, you have to measure a million ligands. You can measure 60 and get an estimate. I claim that you can measure. I think it's sort of an element of beauty here, that you can show that by titrating a crude mixture of receptors and just looking at the shape of the curve, you can get an estimate. But the question is good, because I will immediately show you that we use much more data. That is the major point I'm trying to make. If you have a model, if you measure up here, you can infer the tail. I will immediately show it to you. This is a simple model. That's exactly, if you went away with one notion, it is that I'm trying to propose a simple model that works, that can further be elaborated and tested. You wanted to ask?
You assume the binomial distribution, which is derived from the simple model, and then you fit any given.
Let's show you the data. I will show you the data. Because it's better that you let me go a few slides, and then I'll show you some more data. So let me say a few words about the principles here. The principle is, if by a million experiments or by one experiment you get a good estimate of what the curve looks like, then you have some interesting information. And that is one thing that I want to convey to you, which I think is quite central to our thinking. Different repertoires have evolved to contain different numbers of members. Olfaction, only a few hundred to 1,000. The immune system, 10 million, 100 million with somatic mutations. Why? What is there to gain? Simple-mindedly, you would say more receptors will bind more ligands. We say slightly differently. We say, give me an arbitrary ligand. If you have a better repertoire, a larger repertoire, the average affinity of the best binder in that repertoire to this ligand would be better. So we claim there might be a relationship between the maximal affinity displayed by a repertoire on average towards an arbitrary ligand, between that maximal affinity and the size of the repertoire. This is a nice relationship. It's actually a very simple-minded. Again, you say, if I need, typically, and it will come to you immediately in the next slide or two, as a way to extract more information from data in the literature. If you do an experiment, a real experiment, like a phage display experiment, in which you make a library of, say, 64 million peptides, you throw these in a large, high-throughput screening paradigm onto a target. And you end up with one or a few best binders. What will be the affinity of that binder? Interestingly, it has been known in the literature that there is a relationship between this best one that you get and the size of the repertoire that you used. If you use a hexamer, you get worse on average. Use a decapentamer, you get better, and so on. So this relationship of N equals about to 1 over psi of K max is very central to our thinking. The idea being that you go along this curve, and if you wish to have an average, a typical success of a 10 nanomolar affinity, which is 10 to the 8 molar to the minus 1, you have to use, if this curve is right, you have to use a repertoire of a million. So by looking at data such as those, I will immediately show you a few more confirmations to some of the parameters that we have extracted. And we used this early on to try to infer what at that time was an unknown size for the olfactory repertoire. We knew the size of the immune repertoire, so we had one point on this curve, But we didn't know the immune, the olfactory repertoire. The immune we did, the olfactory we didn't. Now, what we did know, and this is something that I was asked in the break, what is the typical affinity of an olfactory ligand? Because there is a lot of amplification there with the G protein, etc., etc., it looks as if, and this was tested experimentally, that ligands with affinity of 10 micromolar, which is relatively weak, can titillate our nose quite significantly, even if present in the air at low concentrations. So because of the amplification. So the point on this axis, which we have to concentrate on for olfaction, is around here, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. And if this curve is believable, then the repertoire should be around here, 1 over this, which is about 1,000. And we stood up and said the repertoire should be about 1,000 based on very, very crude data. Turned out to be exactly right. So to you it may sound like trivial that there are 1,000 receptors, but there could have been many more. If olfaction couldn't work at 10 to the 5 affinity levels, it would have had invented a mechanism such as the immune system's mechanism to diversify 4 orders of magnitude more than 1,000. If you include the dead, if you don't include the dead, it's about 300 or 400 in human beings, but it's the same order of magnitude. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm missing. Why the binding energy has to be like 5?
This is based on what we know from reality. You titrate, you take single cells and you titrate ligands into them and you measure their electrical activity. And by a long procession of doing real experiments in human beings, in cells, in pieces of tissue, you get sort of a sphere of action for the olfactory system, which is relatively weak. By the way, many ligands in the brain, like adrenergic ligands and dopaminergic ligands and serotonin and so on and so forth, bind with similar affinities to their receptors. Not nanomolar, but micromolar. So there is, it's not completely surprising. Yes, David. Sure? Okay. So this was a prediction based on a very crude set of parameters that we got, in which we said 10 to the 5 means this kind of repertoire, 10 to the 8, which is typical for the immune system, means 10 to the 6 or higher repertoire. So there is some insight in that, we think. Now to some more data that we were collecting in the literature from these three laboratories, and they are shown in their respective colors here. Now what do we see? The three sets of data are laborious. The red and the green are laborious measurements, individual binding measurements for thousands of ligands that people have done at one window of opportunity in immunology. This was in vogue, to take an immunoglobulin and screen it with many, many ligands. Initially, it was thought as a futile activity because an antibody should only bind one ligand, some people thought. But immediately when it was realized by Frank Richards and others, that there was multispecificity as the name of the game in the immune system, people began to ask how many ligands could bind and with what affinities. And they had these numbers stored in the data banks, actually in writing. I had to extract them from written record. And you then divide them into affinity bins, and you plot them along the same curve. Probability, this is actually integral probability, versus binding affinity. So there is one data set here, and there is another data set here. And the third data by Larry Cover, I will not have time to discuss this in detail, but he has a wonderful idea that I really like, which is called affinity fingerprinting. And he shows that actually you can define every ligand in the world, just like in the olfactory system, by way of a vector that is maybe 20 long. Take any 20 proteins, measure the affinity of each to a ligand, and then to another ligand, and then to another ligand, and you construct effective shape space this way by what he calls affinity fingerprinting. And some of his data were used also, and they nicely coincide with the green data set. Now, the curves are now with a Poisson approximation, in which lambda equals to the ratio of the previous parameters defined. Alpha comes out different from before. And there is also, but I will not have time to discuss this in detail, a relationship between this and that. There is an interplay between the two. So we tried to look at a family of curves. Now there were models in the literature, such as for example the one shown here, or the one almost invisible here, that were purportedly a description of what nature behaves like. And you see that they are quite different, at least in this particular range of parameter of binding values. Now, you must realize that what the three curves that you see here, green, blue, and red, are all relatively low affinity binding, because you take an immunoglobulin and you throw in arbitrary ligands. And the binding constants that you get are millimolar, 100 micromolar, 10 micromolar, very weak binding constants. Now, there are data sets in the literature, to be shown immediately, that go into higher affinity domains. And these are data from phage display peptides and immunoglobulin libraries and the like. Now, the data we saw in the previous slide are now up here because I extended on a logarithmic scale both ways the scale. And all of these points that you see here are points of the kind that we inferred from the size of the repertoire used in a given experiment. Each point is a set of a large number of measurements and screening data. But it only encompasses the best binder and the size of the repertoire. So we took for each of them the affinity of the best binder, like here, 10 to the 9, and the repertoire screened was 10 to the 11. Here, it was best binder, 10 to the 7, and the repertoire screened, 10 to the 8 members, and so on and so forth. And we put them on this curve. When I asked people in this field, and they have been doing these experiments ad nauseum, many times repeated, they had known earlier on, and it is in the literature, that if you do this many times, you get some kind of a magic slope here. That is, in order to get one order of magnitude better average affinity from a screen endeavor, you have to go 100 times higher in repertoire size. So this was known, and these curves actually depict quite nicely this slope in this region, and also somewhat fit here. So I would say between here and here lies some of the truth. These are the three other models. One of them is here. One of them, which is very nice for low affinity, becomes terrible for high affinity. And one of them is here, which is not too bad. It's very difficult to see. That's the log normal, log linear, and the Inman model. Inman actually fitted his own data. So these are the data here. These are Inman, and these are Varga. So what is the take-home message from all of this? This plot brings together two realms of endeavor. One is the low affinity realm, in which people just laboriously screen without much hope of getting high affinity. So they screen a few hundred or a few thousand ligands for a given target. And this particular kind is when you screen many, many more ligands and you get points with higher affinity. And we feel that it is nice that the model somehow describes the trend. I would not say more than that. The trend that connects between the low affinity data and the high affinity data. Now, I'm almost out of time, so I will not have time to discuss too much. I will probably stop here. I'll stop here by saying that that in talks we had heard before, people were asking the question, what is the relationship between specific binding and non-specific binding? Everybody agrees that specific binding is what you measure to a real good target, and non-specific binding is whatever background there is. What we propose is that when you have, you can have your target far removed from the distribution, as we heard before about DNA binding proteins. But we also heard about the possibility that they would merge together, depending on how many genomic segments you consider. So as a matter of principle, I feel that it would be nice to give a general description or a general definition, and that is utilize the shape of this curve and say, this is the K that you get. This part is the non-specific binding. This part is the specific binding. And it's sort of as if we artificially raise the probability of a given value of affinity by adding, by spiking a system with specific receptors or specific antibodies. And we have a parameter that we define as a signal-to-noise ratio, and it can be actually rationalized in terms of the function psi and the two binding constants. The binding constant K prime, which is the specific binding half saturates at H equals K prime. So what we say is that there is we take a particular concentration and we ask what would be the effective binding constant that would half saturate for the entire distribution. I don't have time now to go into all the details, But what is important is that there is a way to define in a rigorous fashion for every point what is specific, what is non-specific. And the last slide that I'm going to show you is this. If your your effective binding constant that you are interested in is in this range, I'm comparing how much. Okay, let me try to explain. This is a little convoluted. The spiking, you have a population, a gemisch, and you add in what you call the specific receptor. How much do you have to add in order to see a signal-to-noise ratio of 3? If the binder that you are after has an affinity of 10 to the 7, it can constitute 0.01% of the gemisch, and it will show. But if you are interested in something like 10 to the 4 affinity, then it has to constitute 5% of all to be seen. So this is a sort of a ballpark estimate of what, in immunology, for example, what you start with is a mixture of all the different kinds, and by immunizing, you enhance certain clones to become higher and higher percentage of the entire mixture. And it gives you an estimate of how much expansion of clones you have to make, to undergo, in order for specific to move out of the background of non-specific. And I'm going to skip this. Maybe just to say, maybe this is a good point to stop, to say that because of the lower effective affinity, and not because of any other magical reason, the olfactory system is more promiscuous, we say. That is one of our inferences. Therefore, it gives a sort of a gestalt of many receptors that interact with each ligand, while in the immune system, there is a sparser pattern. And the last, and leading to the talk that I will give next month, is the idea that you can use the same notion of probabilistic binding and of affinity distribution to describe not what happens between a given ligand and a given receptor and many different ligands, or vice versa, but what happens when you confront two random repertoires, or actually it's one random repertoire, the members of which can interact in every old way with each other. And we think that this could be a good description for the random chemistry, the planetary random chemistry, that took place when life began. And I will talk about this next time. Thank you.